Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. As the college application season is winding down, for many students, that means the end of a years-long process of testing, tutoring, and extracurriculars, all to secure a spot at a selective college. For years, critics of the SAT have argued that the college admissions test disadvantages poorer students, but Harvard Law School professor Lonnie Guinier says the problem with the test is even bigger than that. She says it's harming the mission of higher education. Guinier outlines this in her new book, The Tyranny of Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. And Lonnie Guinier is with us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for inviting me.
Listeners, we want to hear from you as well. Were you racing to get the best scores and get into the most competitive college, or did you struggle against that and buck the tide? Do you think that focusing on tests like the SAT can send the wrong message, or how do we measure students' aptitude? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Radio Boston. And Lonnie Guinier, let's start with sort of what's new about your discussion about the SAT. We've heard for a long time that it can disadvantage poorer students, but you're saying that it's bigger, that it actually harms the mission of higher education institutions, right? Do you want to explain?
Well, the SAT is premised on several assumptions that I take issue with. It's premised on the assumption that you can predict who's going to do well in school based on their SAT scores. And that's also true of law schools, which is where I teach. And I've had the opportunity of actually evaluating the relationship between the LSAT and the performance of law schools at the University of Pennsylvania. This is now 20 years old. And one of the most interesting findings was that performance on the LSAT predicted 14% of the variance in first-year grades, and it did a little better second year, 15% of the variance, meaning that performance on the LSAT was not a true predictor of who's going to do well and who's not.
And it was designed really only to predict how a student would do in the first year of school. Is that right?
That's right.
So remind us a little bit of how we even got to the point where we have an SAT and what happened here, why we need it, why we thought we needed it.
I caught
myself.
Well, there's a history of the SAT that has been documented by a number of excellent books, and the key point with the SAT or the particular problem that I see with the SAT is that it assumes that it's in a position to identify who's smart and who's not, when in fact what the SAT is predicting is whose parents have the money for them to go to get help in preparing for the SAT.
So we've heard this before, and we've certainly heard that there are parents who can afford, you know, very expensive...
$30,000.
Right, very expensive prepping coaches and tutoring for the SAT and all kinds of extracurriculars, and you can go volunteer in Costa Rica, right, and do all of these things to pad a resume so a student gets into a selective college. And I think inherently folks know that that obviously skews things for people who have more income to be able to do those kinds of things, because income is required. So what are you saying then? Like, what's new about your argument here?
Well, what's new is that I'm not criticizing the SAT in favor of some other instrument that presumably predicts who's smart and who's not. I'm criticizing the way in which institutions of higher education have abandoned their mission in a democratic society to not only educate citizens, but prepare citizens for positions of leadership, for positions of responsibility in a larger society. That's number one. And number two, that based on the research of a number of academics around the country, Anita Woolley, Carnegie Mellon, and others have identified the relationship between collaborative learning and performance. And it comes out that people who work with other people to figure out how to do calculus, figure out how to do physics, that those students in college actually perform better in terms of mastering the material than students who are just competing in a way that's individualized and alone.
So I wonder if the society, when students get out of school, may value, right, collaboration and teamwork and creativity, creative problem solving and complex problem solving, maybe more so now than ever before, and we're not teaching those things. Does the market almost have a role here in self-correcting?
Yes.
What higher education is doing? Is the market doing that right now?
No.
So if higher education is abandoning its mission, how would you suggest that schools measure students and decide who gets in and how they study and how they design their curricula? I mean, there has to be some way to say, yes, Harvard would be a place for you. Yes, UMass would be a place for you. Isn't that right?
Well, that's certainly true, but that's not actually what I'm focused on, is whether a place would be right for you or wrong for you, because that's something that's above my my capacity to work with figures and numbers. My point is that institutions of higher education are abandoning their mission in preparing students to work collaboratively to solve problems that go beyond the individual to the larger society.
And what does it have to do with the SAT, and how does that reflect that the universities are abandoning their mission?
Well, I don't focus only on the SAT, mm-hmm. so I don't want to make it seem as if this is a conversation all about the SAT. It's really a conversation about the important work that colleges can contribution that colleges can play in developing students, educating students who become quite good at working with other students to solve problems, rather than looking at each student individually as if he or she alone is going to be brilliant.
Okay, so what you're saying then is these tests are measuring an individual when universities should foster more of a collective thing.
Well, it's measuring a certain aspect of an individual, not just an individual.
Okay, so but again, how would a school measure a student and be able to make a decision? We find out that schools, very selective schools right now, like a Harvard or a Yale, admit less than 10% of those who apply. How would they be able to structure an admission process if they didn't have sort of, some kind of a way to figure out?
I'm certainly not saying that Harvard should admit all of the students who apply, but I am saying that one of the things that institutions of higher education will benefit from, as well as the larger society will benefit from, students who learn how to work together to solve problems. So the examples that I talk about in the book involve physics, involve calculus, and the way in which students who teach each other do better on the calculus exams, do better on the physics exams when they work with other people who are in their class to solve problems and to educate or to learn from each other's experience and each other's understanding.
Mm-hmm. Let's go. We have callers who want to talk about this. Audrey is calling from Brighton. Audrey, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. I have two things really quickly. The first one was that I don't think it's correct that the SAT was instituted to enable students whose parents could afford to help them get good educations for them to succeed in getting into school. It was actually designed to help poor students whose only means of winning a place in those schools was to have some outside standard other than what country club their father belonged to, mm-hmm. for them to gain admittance. And the second thing, really, is there's been a lot of research currently that says major innovative breakthroughs don't come from groups. They come from individuals who, in the workplace, for example, have time to go off by themselves and think about problems deeply. Mm-hmm. And the same thing in science. So I think while collaborative work is really important, it isn't all that matters. And our schools do have to focus on taking students who they perceive to be intellectually capable and really grooming them so they can innovate and improve things indirectly for everybody.
Okay. Let's take some of your questions and your comments to Lonnie Guineer. Lonnie Guineer, she says the SAT was designed to sort of level the playing field, to make sure that kids who, you know, weren't getting into school based on what country clubs their family belonged to, and she feels that it's been successful in doing that, and that the major innovations in society have been done by the individual and not by collaboration. What do you say to that?
Well, she has a different premise on which she's working than I am. So her argument makes sense if that's your premise. And her premise is that what we're looking for are individuals who are very smart and who can learn things quickly and who then can use their smartness to become rich. And what I'm suggesting is that the purpose and the goal of higher education in the United States is not simply to develop rich people. It's to educate a group of potential problem solvers who can work together to help solve, help understand, help intervene in the problems that affect the United States as a country, not just as a group of individuals going to college.
And how or where do we see that you think that higher education's mission has been focused on the creation of wealth or people becoming rich?
Well, if you look at some of the references that I used in the book, one is the Harvard Crimson. And it's, I think, the 2007 May, when the students were getting ready to graduate. And the caption was, "Show him the money." And this was a group of students at Harvard who worked on the Crimson talking about the fact that women at Harvard were not going into the stock market or into capitalism as much as the men. The women want to go to education school. They want to go to medical school. They want to contribute to the larger society. But the dominant theme, at least coming out of that article, was that that's not respected. What's respected is using the Harvard name to be able to become individually very rich.
So basically what you're saying is that a lot of our elite higher education institutions have fostered this sort of competitive spirit where it's folks out for themselves, and the SAT may actually just be a symptom of that overall issue. And that's
yes,
sort of what you're, because it's based on your individual achievement that you think that then you've done this on your own necessarily.
Well, it's not just that you've done it on your own, but what it is that you've done. There's certainly things that you do on your own that you're proud of.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have a group of students who look down on women because they want to be teachers or they want to be doctors or they want to do things to help people, whereas the men want to be rich.
And do you think that's widespread, really?
I can't say that it's widespread. I can say that I saw it in the,
Harvard Crimson. Okay.
And it struck me as problematic.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phones again. We have folks who want to weigh in on this. Natalie is calling from Hudson. Natalie, you're on the air.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call. I did horribly on the SAT. Horribly. I didn't break 1,000. It was terrible. And supposedly that's supposed to tell you how well you do in college, but I went to college and I got a 3.85 average.
Hmm.
So one had absolutely nothing to do with the other. Following that, I did horribly in the GRE. I did horribly on the GMAT. I couldn't get a graduate school to accept me despite having proven that I could do very well academically, and it's actually prevented me from being able to continue studying something despite having a high IQ and despite knowing that I'm more than capable of doing so.
And why do you think it's difficult for you to take these standardized tests?
I have learning disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
I have a reading disability and a nonverbal learning disorder. It makes it very difficult, and ADD, so it's just sitting there, and they give me extra time, and it doesn't matter if I'm there 8 hours. I just can't sit there for that long.
You know, let's ask something of Lonnie Guinier about this. You know, we do hear a lot, certainly within the past 10 years or so, schools have become test optional. They say they don't rely on these tests as much anymore. But as Natalie says, it's limiting her ability for graduate school and things like that, despite her academic record. How important are the test scores? Are they still as important as ever, or do you think it's changing?
Well, when you say important to whom? To the schools, they're important. To the students who are taking the test, they are important. But to the larger society, no.
But are they, in terms of her being, in terms of Natalie being able to go forward, to go to graduate school, she says, you know, it's very limiting to her because she didn't do well on the tests. Haven't we reached the point where we look at students more holistically?
Yes. That's part of what I'm advocating, but I'm not just asking to look at the student holistically. I'm asking whether the students can work with other students to solve problems that affect not only them but others. That is, to contribute in a way that the larger society also benefits, not just the beneficiaries of admission to an elite school.
Mm-hmm. And what would your advice be to someone like Natalie?
My advice to Natalie is that she's doing a great job. If she gets the job, she does a good job, and she shouldn't internalize and feel bad about her performance on these tests.
Okay. Richard is calling from Hopkinton. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi there. Hello, Professor Guinier. I think that you're making a very good point, but I think it also loses sight of the financial issues that are facing colleges today. Part of the reason I think that you have competitive natures and having prestigious colleges wanting to be selective in terms of who they bring into their colleges, but these people will ultimately become the alumni that will hopefully sustain and support that college in future years. So what you're really doing, what the colleges are really doing, is not so much preparing the student to be a well-rounded individual, but rather a moneymaker so that they can then take a portion, hopefully, of that largesse in the future to allow the institution to remain self-sustaining.
Well, that's a really cynical look at things. We want them to just go for wealth so we can have some of it later when we ask them to donate as alums. Is that what you're saying?
Well, if you look at the size of the endowment of colleges such as Harvard, Yale, and Dartmouth, they are, by and large, the largest of any college, I guess, in the United States, as it turns out. It's not a question of simply being cynical. It's also a question of the rationale, ultimately, behind why these colleges operate the way they do.
Lonnie Guinier, is there something to be said about that?
Well, there's definitely something to be said, but I would take it in a different direction. I'm not here to challenge Harvard, Yale, Dartmouth about the important roles that they've played in educating citizens for a democracy. What I'm proposing is that our focus on what excellence looks like needs to be reexamined, and that excellence is the ability to work with others to solve complex problems that you alone can't do. So this is really a book about the importance of collaboration and the power of working with other people, even when they are your peers, to solve problems, to learn how to do calculus, to learn how to do physics. This is something that you can learn together, as opposed to something in which you learn against competing or
right.
with competing against your classmates.
I'm sure we could keep talking about this. Let's hope it changes. It's going to take more than one person to change it if it does. Lonnie Guinier, Harvard Law School professor and author of The Tyranny of Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. She'll be discussing her book at the Harvard Bookstore on February 9th. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Stay with us. There's more of Radio Boston just ahead.